No? Come on, what's wrong with you, man? Now you gotta give me a hug too. Good to see you, sweetheart.
Good to see you.
There you go. Which one? You want a certain flavor?
Oh.
You take one? Right over. There you go. Here you go, John. No? No? Ready? All right, everybody covered? Did I miss anybody? Did you get one? All right, so we are moving on tonight. Hallelujah, huh? This is, I number all of my presentations when I make them, and this is number 19. So yeah, 66 books, 20 slides each. That's, we're gonna be here a long time, huh? Now, we'll try to speed it up from here. It's so hard. My wife will tell you I tend to get long-winded and yappy, and you know, especially when I get on a roll on something, and I have a hard time. I don't know how. You know, I told you guys earlier on that I'm following a book written by Brother Frank Chesser. He's a minister up from Montgomery who I respect dearly. He's kind of his book is what I'm using to kind of guide my studies here on, and I don't know how he compiled everything that he did into a book about that thick. I mean, if I was writing it, you know, and especially, you know, when I went through this study with him years ago, back in the early 2000s, I think it took him 2 or 3 years to cover it all. A lot of it is due just to his repetitiveness. You know, he repeated, repetition was his motto. And so he repeated a lot. You all right, Dan?
Can I interrupt real quick?
Yeah.
Hey, wanted to check on Marion. And Marion's been to the ER a couple times this week, and he has a serious urinary tract infection. So that's the answer on Marion. Sorry to interrupt your class. But,
no worries.
He's home now?
He's home now, yep.
Okay.
He said it's been a bad week.
Yeah, it's been a bad week for
him. All right. So yeah, anyhow, I don't know, I find myself debating, you know, I come across a certain passage or a certain verse and I'm like, oh man, I could really use this and go off of something on this, but you know, it ends up going way off the slide and it's like, okay, I find myself having to fight what to put on and what to include and what to not include. And so, anyhow, I'm going to try to speed things up. I'm not going to make any promises. Exodus is a fun book. I really like the stories of Exodus. There's a lot of exciting stuff in there. And so I'm really going to fight the urge to spend another 20 weeks just in the book of Exodus. But no promises, okay? Don't hold me to it. All right, so we're talking about the scheme of redemption, and we've talked a lot about some of the goals of our studies. And when it just comes down to it, our goal is to learn more about God. To learn more about our Father, to learn more about His Son, and the awesomeness of being redeemed, to be bought back. And so, you know, we're one of the many things we're focusing on also is this book we know as the Bible. Okay, this thing has been compiled into a single book for us. We've seen it as 66 different books, but I've challenged you guys to read it instead as one novel with 66 different chapters. And it's important for us to understand what's going on through the whole book. You know, it just doesn't work to pick it up at chapter 44 and have a good understanding of what's going on. You know, we see a lot of that going on today, and it's kind of makes sense to us why people don't really understand the Bible and what it's all about, and why they look at us like we're a bunch of nuts. You know, well, they don't understand the whole story. You have to know the characters. You have to know the history and the background to understand what's going on when you hit the chapter of Matthew in this big book. All right? If you don't know everything that's happened before, Matthew is just kind of, huh? You know, all of a sudden this guy shows up on the scene from a mother who was a virgin. And that's right out the gate in Matthew. And, you know, so we can understand why people sometimes pick up this thing and, well, let me read about Jesus and this makes no sense. Well, that's because they don't know the whole story. And so as God's people, as His children, it's important for us to know where we came from, how we got here on the orange carpet, where we are tonight, what it means to be a Christian, what this glorious thing called the church is, and how it all came to be, why we're even here. You know, we have to understand all that stuff. And so we have spent a great deal of time over the past many months, going over this and understanding what God intended in the beginning and the way He made it, how we messed it all up. I mean, we completely blew it to smithereens. And what God has now been doing and what He has done to remedy that problem and restore us back into a relationship with Him. All right, so we've talked about Genesis 1 and 2. It's God in perfection, man in innocence. You know, in Genesis 1 and 2, there was no sin. Man was innocent, completely and utterly innocent. Everything was perfect. There were no issues. You know, Adam and Eve didn't go to bed at night stressing about the day. You know, and Adam didn't wake up in the mornings thinking, okay, well, I've got to survive. I've got to care for my family. I've got to. Eve didn't wake up going crazy trying to, you know, chase kids around and figure out how she was going to get them this on time, that on time, and, you know. That kind of life just did not exist in the garden, right? The life that we know today, this life of stress and struggle and strife, just did not exist in Genesis 1 and 2. That was not that world. The world of Genesis 1 and 2 was one of peace, one of comfort, one of no guilt, no consequences, no sin, no strife, no pain. It's just a world that you and I could only dream about today. And so Genesis 3 through 12, we looked at as the background of redemption. In Genesis 12 through 50, we've looked at the lives of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and how God moved through these men and getting onto the road of redemption. So now we're in Exodus, and Exodus chapters 1 through 12, we'll probably spend a couple weeks here, including tonight. Slavery in and judgment upon Egypt. That's going to be our next section that we're going to tackle. All right, so just some recaps. You know, Abraham was made three promises. All right, and these three promises are important. They're critical. These three promises we're going to see. It's these promises that the rest of the story of redemption hangs upon. Okay? And it's important that we have these in our minds and in our memories as we go through this, because we're going to see these things played out. We're going to see these promises being fulfilled and played out through our study. And so, first promise was that God would make of Abraham a great nation, that his descendants would inherit the land of Canaan was the second promise, and that through his lineage all the nations of the earth would be blessed. We've talked about how we tonight, this very second, are benefactors of that third promise. Because it's through the line of Abraham came Christ, who, of course, the whole world has been blessed by. Through Christ, everyone can be saved. Everyone can be brought back to God. There's no one who cannot be restored back to God and come back into that relationship with Him. And so to this very moment in time, you and I are benefactors of this promise. We also looked at how these promises were also made verbatim to Isaac and Jacob, whose name was later changed to Israel. All right, so Jacob had 12 sons, 10 of which would become the tribes of Israel, along with Joseph's two sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. Joseph and Levi would not become tribes in and of themselves. Levi was a tribe, but it was the priestly tribe. And so he was not one that gained a territory, as it were, in the land of Canaan, but that's all stuff to come. Joseph, instead of he becoming a tribe, he basically became two tribes through his sons. And so from these 12 came the 12 tribes of Israel. And so Genesis ends with a backward look at the promises made and a forward look to the promises being realized with the dying words of both Jacob and Joseph. And we looked at that last week. We looked at how when they both died, right? So when Jacob died, he first called Joseph to him. Okay, and he had a conversation with Joseph. He had a conversation with Joseph's two sons. And in that conversation, Jacob looked back. He looked back over his life and he talked to Joseph about the promises that were made to him. He says, back when I was in Luz, God spoke to me, he met with me, and here's what he said. Jacob was looking back at those promises. And then he turned around and looked forward. And his last dying wish was that he would be taken back to Canaan and buried in the cave where Abraham, Sarah, Leah, and Rebecca were buried, and Isaac as well, I think. Okay, so Jacob understood that the land of Canaan would be the place that he would call home eventually, were he to continue on living for hundreds of more years. See, he looked back. He looked back at the promises, and he looked forward to those promises one day being fulfilled. And Joseph took stake in that. Joseph himself also said, his family make the same promise when he was on his deathbed. Right as he was about to die, he said, look, you know I'm going to be buried here in Egypt and all that. He said, but you don't leave me here. He said, one day God is going to carry y'all out of here. You carry me with you. And we see that played out. Later on in Joshua, there's a passage there where it talks that Joshua's bones were carried out with Israel as they left Egypt and as they went into the conquest, and eventually he was buried in Canaan. So both Jacob and Joseph had that backward look at the promises made and then looked forward to those promises being fulfilled. And that's how we ended off with Genesis. And so now we're getting into Exodus, and so this is just an overview of what's to come. Slavery in Egypt, the birth and life of Moses, God commissioning Moses and Aaron to go and confront the Pharaoh and say, hey, you know, let the people of Israel go. The 10 plagues, the Passover, Exodus from Egypt. So when we talk about Exodus, what do we mean? What's the one word that we mean? Leaving, exiting, yeah, okay, leaving, all right? So the Exodus is the leaving of Egypt, the exiting out of Egypt, all right? The crossing, the parting of the Red Sea, the journey to Mount Sinai. It was a rather eventful journey. We got some things to talk about there. The giving of the law and the Ten Commandments, Aaron, Israelites, and the golden calf. Again, a story there to be shared, you know, some lessons to be learned there. And then the building of the tabernacle. All right, in Exodus, as quickly as the first chapter, we see both prophecy and promise being fulfilled right up front, all right? And so the promise that we see being fulfilled is that God would make Abraham into a great nation. And the prophecy that we see in play is that Abraham's descendants would be oppressed, but that God would judge their oppressors. We're going to see these things played out in the book of Exodus. You know, these are two of the three promises that were made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And these two, one promise is one of the three that were played out. And so in this book, and we see that right up front. So what we see here is Genesis chapter 15, verses 13 through 14. You may remember discussing this many, many, many weeks ago. All right, we looked at this passage where God meets Abraham, and he actually calls Abraham to fall into a trance, and there's this terrifying vision given to Abraham. It says that great fear came over Abraham as he has this vision, and God said to him, "Know for certain that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. But I will also judge the nation whom they will serve, and afterward they will come out with many possessions." We will see this prophecy fulfilled in this book to the T. Also, we see a promise being fulfilled right up front. Again, Exodus chapter 1, 8 through 11. Would somebody like to read?
Of
hard labor.
Thank you, sir. All right, so right up front, we see there, you know, behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we. Now, this is the king of Egypt, Pharaoh, saying this, okay? Recognizing this about the nation of Israel that is co-dwelling within the land of Egypt. If you remember when Jacob and his family moved to Egypt, do you remember how many people came with them? 70 of his direct bloodline. Yeah. There's obviously more than that, you know, wives, servants, who, you know, whatever else, but certainly 70 of a direct bloodline with him entered into Egypt. Do you remember the land that they were given? The land of Goshen, that's right. Yeah, they were given the land of Goshen. And I mean, man, they just took off. And so they clearly by this time, they have grown into a tremendous amount of people, a large nation within a nation. And it's really concerning this Pharaoh who did not know Joseph. Clearly some time has passed. We don't exactly know how many years have passed, but clearly enough time to where this Pharaoh was not familiar with Joseph and had any kind of a relationship with Joseph, as it were. Exodus chapter 1, verses 15 through 17. Somebody like to read.
Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives. One of them was named Pharaoh. And the other was named Judah. And he said, when we are having Hebrew women to give birth,
all right, verses 18 through 22. All right. Again, you know, we're looking back here, right? We see the prophecy that God told Abraham starting to pick up. You know, God told him, look, things are going to be bad for your descendants in this land. And we see it starting. You know, the Pharaoh's already becoming real nervous about, you know, the nation of Israel and them possibly taking over Egypt should an adversary come in. You know, his fear is that, hey, if an adversary comes in and goes to war against us, these Israel people, they might join up with the adversary and just wipe us out. And so we got to do something about this. And so he starts putting a plan into action to put an end to this. I thought I had some other slides in there. I guess I didn't. And so we see him putting this plan of action into place to handle this situation in a way that he saw best. And we also can see here that, you know, and I hope I'm not getting ahead of myself. Again, I thought I had another slide in there, but it doesn't seem to be. But we can see what's going on here is that Pharaoh, he's an obstacle. Now, unbeknownst to him, mind you, he's an obstacle here that's trying to stand in the way of God's path to the cross. Okay? God's working on getting to the cross. And Pharaoh's standing here in the way saying, well, I might just put an end to this. You know, I'm just going to put an end to this nation right now by killing all the males. Problem solved in time. All right. Well, God obviously says, I don't think so. And moves him out of the way. And we'll see that play out. And again, this is something I have talked about in here before, and we will continue to see happen. God was going to get to the cross one way or another. Nothing was going to stand in his way. End of discussion. And that is a fact that we will see again and again and again and again as we go through the story of redemption, especially all through the Old Testament. There's many instances where somebody stands in the way and tries to put an end to what God is doing. Really, all in most of these circumstances, they're just trying to put an end to the people of Israel and the people of God. But what they don't know is that they're standing in the path to the cross, and God wasn't going to have it. And so we will see God take action and move these people out of the way rather quickly. What does it say, these midwives here? We see them fearing God rather than the Pharaoh. And because of that, they take action. And they completely and utterly disregard the command from the Pharaoh himself, possibly at the threat of the peril of their own lives.
Do you think the midwives purposely lied, or did they lie about it?
I think they lied about it. That's what it sounds like to me. Because, you know, I mean, it specifically says that they feared God, which leads us to believe that, you know, because they feared God, they weren't gonna be putting any of these children to death. What does that say for us? What is something we can take away from that? Notice here that it says because the midwives feared God and because of their actions, you know, how they handled this, he established households for them. Basically, he took care of them, provided for them. You know, what does that say? What's the lesson for us? Yeah, we've got to have faith. We've got to do what's right, even if it means just being outright disobedient about it, right, to somebody else. You know, we have to serve God above anything else. God has to come before our families. God has to come before our jobs. God has to come before government leaders. You name it. Now, I'm not sitting here trying to make a political statement. Don't take it that way. That's not what I'm trying to say. All I'm trying to say is God has got to be number one in our lives. And everything we do, every decision we make has to be filtered through that. And if we can't filter a decision through God in a way that we want to go, then we just need to stop right then and there and head off the other direction. And we have to trust, as Lynn said, that God will provide and that God will take care. Because sometimes that can be a scary situation. I get the feeling that these midwives were probably a little nervous about this. You know, you have the Pharaoh himself saying, hey, you're going to do this. I mean, when you have a leader who is telling you to kill the children because I want to put an end to this, he's obviously not somebody to be toying around with. You know, he's not someone to take lightly. But yet, they stand right up to him in their own special way and say, nah, we're not doing that. And we see that God takes care of them and helps them out with that. And so that's a lesson we need to take from this and that we need to look at this. All right. So just how long was it? So there's a lot of discussion about the length of time that passed in Egypt from the time Jacob came in to the time they left. We see back in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 13, God told Abraham, your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, where they will be enslaved and oppressed 400 years. And we're going to look at some other passages here where the numbers start changing on us and things don't really seem to add up and make sense. I'm going to sit here and tell you, I don't have the answer on it, okay? But I will tell you what I found and what might just work best. But when it just comes down to it, there's still a lot of people. No one has just flat out come out and said, this is precisely the way it went, because it's a very hard thing to figure out, and we'll look at that. So we have that one. Well, they're going to be enslaved and oppressed for 400 years. In Exodus chapter 12, verses 40 through 41, just a quick looking forward, what's going on here is that the Passover has taken place, and and the Israelites are on the verge of leaving and heading out towards the Red Sea and making their way out of Egypt, okay? They're just right on the eve of that. And so here it says, now the time that the sons of Israel lived in Egypt was 430 years, and at the end of 430 years, to the very day, all the host of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. Using genealogical records, if we look at Exodus chapter 6, 16 through 20, 1 Chronicles 6:1, and 1 Chronicles 23:6-13, these three passages all reference some genealogical data. So-and-so lived this long and this long and this long, and he was this old when he was born, and then he died, and then, you know, so from that, a lot of times we can come up with a timeline, right? And so those passages do that, and when you add all that up, the number comes to be more around 350 years that they were in Egypt. And then in Acts chapter 7 and verse 6, Stephen is recalling, and this is when Stephen is having his time before the council and Sanhedrin and all these people, and he's giving his defense. And in that, he recalls that the 400 years that God told Abraham that his descendants would be enslaved and mistreated for. So Stephen uses the 400 number. And then we go over to Galatians chapter 3, verse 17, where Paul is speaking, and he says, now the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say, and to seeds, as referring to many, but rather to one, and to your seed. That is Christ. And so Paul is reaffirming here the promise, you know, that the seed, through Abraham's seed, all the nations would be blessed. You know, through Abraham's seed. Again, talking about Christ is what Paul is saying. And so then he says, what I'm saying is this, the law, which came 430 years later, does not invalidate a covenant previously ratified by God so as to nullify the promise. So Paul's kind of saying here, so Abraham received the promises back in Genesis 12. 430 years later, the law came at Sinai. So Paul is kind of stretching this thing out even longer, it seems. He's saying from Genesis 12 all the way to Sinai was 430 years. And so we have all these varying, you know, this one says it was 400 years in Egypt. This one says it was 430 years in Egypt to the very day. This one says it was 430 years from Genesis 12 to Sinai. How do we reconcile all this? That's it. Yeah. One of the, you know, the one that the view I've always had, and I'm afraid I might have been wrong on it, is that it kind of has the appearance that maybe 245 years has passed since the promises were made to the time they left Egypt, okay? So you see I have the 430 plus 215. The 215 comes from the genealogical records from Abraham to Jacob. Okay, we have all those numbers. He was this old when so-and-so was born, and then he died, and then so-and-so was this old when his son was born, and on and on and on. And using all that data, we can come up with 215-year time span between Abraham receiving the promises and Jacob coming into Egypt. 215 years. But then we have this number 430, you know, Exodus, Paul. Hey, they were in Egypt 430 years. And so on the surface, it seems that 645 years total had passed from Abraham to exiting of Egypt, Sinai, that time frame. Roughly 645 years. So was Paul and Moses wrong? Who was wrong? What are we looking at here? The other problem that we run into is the 430 years, if we look at 430 from the time Jacob came into Egypt by the time they left Egypt, okay? We also have a problem with the genealogies in that time frame not adding up. Moses' mother was Jochebed. Jochebed was the daughter of Levi. Now, according to a lot of the calculations and stuff, Levi was probably in his mid-40s. When Jacob and the family came into Egypt. So at the best case scenario, let's assume that Jochebed was born on the very last day of Levi's life, okay? We're going to just push it out as far as we can into time when Jochebed was born, okay? She would have had to been 257 years old when she gave birth to Moses to make that 430 years fit, because we're given Moses' age. We're told that Moses was about 80 years old when he was confronting the Pharaoh and, hey, let my people go, and the plagues and all that. Moses was near 80 by that time. So using some math and all that kind of mess, we can roughly guesstimate that the best case, she would have had to been 257 years old when she gave birth to Moses to make the 430 years fit from Jacob to Exodus, or to leaving Egypt. That's just really hard to believe. Even Sarah herself was, you know, this is about three times the age of Sarah when Isaac was born. And so that's just unheard of. Even on a biblical scale, we see no examples of people being born in their late 200s. And we can also keep in mind that by this time, people just weren't living that long anymore. They were maybe living a little beyond 100, and that's about it, 130 maybe. Okay? Back in the time of Moses, oh yeah, man, people were living hundreds of years. But by this time, the human lifespan had really dwindled down into only about 100 or so. So, I went to my only other trusted source that I have. You know, there's a lot of articles out there if you're interested in just going and doing some reading. Go Google it. You'll find article after article after article discussing this issue. And it's really interesting reading. But I go to Apologetics Press. I've talked to you guys about them before. If you're not familiar with them, they are a organization affiliated with the Churches of Christ and supported by the Church of Christ. As a matter of fact, they're overseen by the Palm Beach Lakes congregation a couple hours south of here, near West Palm Beach. And their research and their authors suggest that the 430-year time span covers from Abraham receiving the promises to the leaving of Egypt, which kind of lines up with what Paul said in Galatians. And so basically what we have is we have a half and half situation. Using the genealogy of Abraham and all of his family, we know there were 215 years prior to Jacob coming into Egypt. And then there would have been another 215 years from Jacob coming into Egypt and then the Israelites leaving Egypt. That's what our brethren at the Apologetics Press have concluded. That's their conclusion on the matter. If you want to go read the article, I highly recommend it. It's kind of long, but it's good. I included a reference here, and there's also a reference on the handout. You can Google Apologetics Press, how long was the Israelites Egyptian bondage. You can Google that, and the article will come up, or you can enter the web address. I added them both there to the bottom. Really good reading. They get into a lot of deep math and genealogy addition of births and deaths and everything else to kind of figure all this up. But I can't remember what Mike's little thing is. You know, take your pick, choose your option, pay at the door, leave your money at the door. I can't remember what he says, but that's the way it comes down to. So. Sorry if that seemed long-winded, but I wanted to cover it because it's interesting. You know, we have these different numbers, and we got to be able to give defense of this stuff somehow, some way. Because believe it or not, it's this kind of stuff that leads the unbelievers and all to say, "See, this thing's messed up. This Bible doesn't add up." Mike.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of options like that, you know. A lot of times, too, people have different ways of saying things, right? You know, somebody could ask both me and you, Mike, what's the temperature outside? Well, I may say it's 90-something degrees Fahrenheit. You may say it's whatever degree Celsius. Both of us are saying different numbers, but we're saying the same thing. Now, granted, you know, we're talking about the counts of years here, so a little, you know, obviously not a a conversion issue, but it could be kind of like you said, Paul was referring to a time frame that included more time than what Stephen was focused on or what Stephen was talking about, you know. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways that we can say that. You know, how many people came into Egypt? 70 people showed up to Egypt. I bet there were more, you know. And so we have to go and look at, okay, well, hang on. You know, that was just 70 who were direct bloodlines. And so, yeah, you know, there's a lot of different ways that that could have played out to come up with all that as well. Yeah. Possibly, yeah. Bob? Yeah.
Another thing I heard and read about this is when they figured out these numbers, when, you know, every 7 years, they were supposed to get 1 year, you know, to land and just take care of itself. And they never did it for 450 years. But God was going to get them back. So now that's deducted from this time.
Well,
so quite a bit to it. It's just like when they were in a, walking in the land for 40 years.
Well, we have to be careful of that because at that, you know, at the time in Egypt, the law didn't exist. The Levitical law didn't exist, and so they may not have done it that way at then. So we have to be careful with that argument. I mean, but yeah, I mean, I hear where you're coming from. But the little Levitical law at that time did not exist. And so we might have to, hard time. Sure. 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 Well, again, the 400 years, the problem we have with that is the genealogy from Levi to Moses. So Levi was one of Jacob's sons that came into Egypt with him. And then Levi, you know, him and his wife gave birth to Jochebed, who was Moses' mother. And so when we add up all the different years from with Levi, Jochebed, and then Moses, Jochebed would have had to be really old to stretch it out. I'm sorry? Aaronites?
Aaronites in Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 12, 26, it says the children of Levi were 4,600. And Jonadab was the leader of the Aaronites. And with them were 3,700.
I'm not certain about that. I don't know. I didn't read that passage. All I know is that all I'm saying is, you know, with Levi and then Moses being near 80 by the time the exiting of Egypt happened, from Levi to Moses, if that time span covered 430 years, Jochebed would have had to been really, really, really old when she gave birth to Moses if all he was 80 years to reach the Exodus. You see what I'm saying? I mean, Levi way back here, Jochebed born way back here, to cover 430 years to where Moses is 80 when they go to leave Egypt. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
That is a long lifespan. No, the genealogical record tells us that Levi was Jochebed's father, who was Moses' mother. So.
And that would be in conflict with your statement about people living shorter span.
Correct. Right.
Do you have any, would you like to theorize as to why people started living?
We talked about that some when we were talking about the flood, and we saw that number start to dwindle quickly post-flood. Noah lived for a good while, a few hundred years afterwards, but after that, I mean, the lifespans of people dropped dramatically after the flood. No. No reason ever given. We had a lot of, what'd you say?
God gives a reason.
He did give a reason?
Yeah, why he limited it to 120 years. I'll find it. He does, he lists it.
Okay.
Sure.
So, you know, we talked about it at that time. We kind of came up with a lot of speculations, but that was really about what it was. Okay. So this was, I thought I'd gotten ahead of myself earlier. So yeah, you know, he you know, we talked about this where the midwives refused to do, and what was the lesson in that for us? We've already discussed that, so we'll move on. All right, so finishing up for tonight. Look at that, I'm actually finishing. Jochebed gives birth to Moses, and she hides him for 3 months. And, you know, at this time, the command was, hey, if you have a child that's born, he's to be thrown into the Nile River. Well, Jochebed wasn't good with that, and she tried to keep him, and it after 3 months, it got really difficult for her to keep Moses hidden as a male infant that she had. And so she takes him, and she puts him in a basket out by the Nile, and lo and behold, the Pharaoh's daughter comes along. Pharaoh's daughter comes down to bathe, and she finds him there, and she feels pity for baby Moses here in the basket, and so she decides that, you know what, I'm going to keep him, and she sends one of her handmaidens and servants to go and find someone to nurse the child, one of the Hebrew women, and well, they go and find Jochebed, and so Jochebed ends up getting Moses back, and the Pharaoh's daughter says, hey, I'll even pay you. And so kind of a double whammy for Jochebed. She gets her kid back and she gets paid to tend to him by the Pharaoh's daughter. So it works out well. So Moses grows and eventually he's delivered to Pharaoh's daughter and he ends up being raised and educated as an Egyptian in Pharaoh's house. And that's where we'll leave off tonight. So next week we'll get into Moses. He's growing up. He's getting more interested and concerned in his people, the Israelites. And then into God's commission to go confront the Pharaoh. All right.